Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama made some remarks about the GM IPO this afternoon. You could almost hear him saying, phew.
American taxpayers are now positioned to recover more than my administration invested in GM. And that's a very good thing.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt, it's more car than electric. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 18th of November. Good to have you here. The basics of the GM IPO we've known for a day or so now, $23 billion plus or minus. The government's now a minority stakeholder. Taxpayers own about a third of the company. But from where the president stood this afternoon in the briefing room at the White House, this is probably the key point.
We are finally beginning to see some of these tough decisions that we made in the midst of crisis pay off.
It's worth a mention here that the auto bailout, just like the bank bailout, actually started with the Bush administration. But the incumbent is getting most of the credit and maybe some of the blame, too. Marketplace's David Gura reports now from Washington.
In 2009, President Obama said GM and the U.S. government had found a way to save the car company from collapse. GM would have to restructure.
Executing this plan will require a substantial amount of money that only a government can provide.
Americans had to become reluctant shareholders, he said.
What we are not doing, what I have no interest in doing, is running GM.
That didn't comfort critics who wondered why U.S. taxpayers should invest almost $50 billion. At the time, Republican lawmaker John Boehner asked whether anyone really believed the government could steer a huge company to economic viability. MP Narayanan teaches business at the University of Michigan. He says it's clear the government has, and if it hadn't,
GM would be still struggling.
Narayanan says the restructuring plan saved jobs and led the company to make cars people want to buy. But taxpayers are still on the hook.
Clearly, the government is going to pay a price because it doesn't look like the government is going to recoup all the investment in GM. It looks very unlikely.
But there are still critics of government intervention. Daniel Eikenson, a Cato Fellow, is one of them.
The costs of the bailout weren't just the money that was fronted.
He says GM's bankruptcy would have provided competitors with fresh talent, and federal dollars gave GM an unfair advantage. Worst of all, now businesses in trouble might think they'll always be able to turn to Uncle Sam for help. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
All the international economic action today was in Dublin, Ireland. Officials from the European Union and the International Monetary Fund are still trying to patch up the Irish financial crisis, including, it sure looks like, a multi-billion dollar bailout package. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
For days, Ireland's government was dead set against any outside help. But this morning, speaking on Irish radio, the head of the country's central bank, Patrick Honohan, admitted that a loan was in the offing. And it was a big one.
The purpose of the amount to be made available to be borrowed is to show that Ireland has sufficient firepower to deal with any concerns of the market.
A loan worth tens of billions of euros. But the rescue package comes with conditions. They're likely to include further public spending cuts. The deal taking shape is a national humiliation, says Irish opposition politician Joe Higgins. He accused the government of
handing over the fate of the Irish people to faceless and unelected and unaccountable operators in the financial markets of the world.
The rescue talks helped take some of the pressure off the euro, but Bronwyn Maddox, editor of Prospect magazine, reckons not for long.
I think it's going to unravel. How long that takes will depend on how long countries want to keep propping up the weaker ones.
That may not be a great deal longer. Germany, which foots much of the bill, is far from happy. The Germans were furious over bailing out the Greeks. Their mood has not been improved by the thought of bailing out Ireland. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The market sure thinks there's a bailout coming. The biggest gainer on Wall Street today, U.S. shares of the Bank of Ireland. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just about a third of the people elected to Congress this month are small business owners in civilian life. And it looks like they're going to have a leg up on the lawyers and the doctors and the politicians who are also part of the incoming freshman class in Washington. Because setting up a political shop on Capitol Hill is a whole lot like starting a small business. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The freshman class of 2010 is getting briefed this week on everything from hiring a staff to serving constituents. The office lottery is tomorrow. When your number is called, you have 5 minutes to choose your office from a rapidly dwindling list.
You know, it's like the NFL draft.
That's freshman Congressman Jeff Denham of California. He owns Denham Plastics. He has 10 employees. He'll be hiring dozens of people to staff his Capitol Hill and district offices. Hiring staff in Washington is also like the NFL draft. There's competition for the best players. Denham is a Republican, but he says he wouldn't hesitate to hire someone who used to work for a Democrat.
You want the best person for the job.
David Schweikert is another freshman entrepreneur. The Arizona Republican co-owns a real estate company. He would also hire a Democrat. In fact, he's only looking at resumes stripped of things like age and party affiliation. He learned that from hiring people for his business. Schweikert says the budgeting experience he and his wife have is also coming in handy.
And so my wife is actually already working on an Excel spreadsheet saying, how much money can we spend on travel? How much can we spend on staff?
Schweikert also knows how to market himself. Good thing, says New York University public service professor Paul Light. He says voter perceptions are important, especially for Tea Party voters who don't like the trappings of power.
You're going to see stories come out about Republicans who really gussied up their offices. You know, people say, oh, hasn't he gotten so high and mighty?
Light says, business person or not, that's the kind of thing that can get you kicked off Capitol Hill. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Whether it's that crisis in Irish finances that Stephen Beard was telling us about a little bit earlier, or Congress today pressing for answers on how foreclosure paperwork could possibly have gotten so messed up, banks are nobody's favorite industry right now. Truth is, though, that we need them. Banks are how money moves around an economy, whether it's ours or Ireland's or the world. So with that in mind, our special correspondent David Brancaccio has been looking at banking as part of our series Economy 4.0, how we can make the global economy work better for more people. Today, David takes us to the Great Plains, the upper Midwest, where they do banking a little bit differently.
We're on 3,300 acres of soybeans and corn near the town of Page, North Dakota. Farm family Randy and Michelle Thompson nearly lost it all in a few minutes of a midsummer day 3 years ago.
You can see the hailstorm right the track that it took, and it came right down the middle of our farm, so it got pretty much everything.
Yeah, that was a tough one, but he was on the phone and he stopped out and said, yeah, it'll be all right. You know, it's the way farming is.
The man who came calling after the hail is named Ron Mueller. Insurance adjuster or clergyman? No. Mueller is president of the Castleton, North Dakota branch of an outfit called Bremer Bank. Mueller is from a farming family. He's known the Thompsons for decades. His decision was to keep the credit flowing to the farm.
You go through adverse conditions, and that's when I think a bank is a bank, is when they're there to help people through that situation, because they'll bounce back.
That confidence is reciprocated by Mr. Thompson, the bank's client.
Oh, I can't imagine working with a national bank. It's so much better to have someone who's aware of everything happening.
Bremer Bank, based in St. Paul, Minnesota, is big on knowing its customers. Intimately, says Bremer's CEO, Pat Donovan.
There are competitors out there. They simply can deliver at reduced fees, et cetera, et cetera. Then there's another niche that wins on technology. They just have more bells and whistles than anyone else. Our niche is based on a customer intimacy model.
Bremer is what's known as a community bank. The idea is when local depositors put money in, the capital then circulates within the region as new loans to other local folk.
It's a very sound idea.
Economic analyst David Corton is author of the book Agenda for a New Economy.
A bank that offers real financial services is very different than a predator bank that is basically trying to extract as much wealth as possible out of the community.
Note that Bremer is a for-profit bank. So far, not so weird. But listen to its structure. 8% of Bremer is owned by its employees, its tellers, loan officers, security guards. And the other 92% of the bank is owned by, get this, a charity. The Bremer Charitable Foundation takes profits and gives them back to the communities the bank serves as grants. There were about $23 million in Bremer grants last year, including $35,000 to Community of Care, a North Dakota nonprofit that helps older people like Louise Flemmer get to doctor's appointments.
Yep, I think it was the 26th or 28th of September.
Founder Otto Bremer looms large in the bank's history. The Schmidt Brewery, owned by the Bremer family, generated early capital for him. Then there's Otto Bremer with a satchel of cash, keeping little banks on the prairie going during the Great Depression. Bremer never married, and when he died nearly 60 years ago, his charitable foundation kept the good works going. The bank's current CEO says staying connected to people has been an asset during these bad times.
I would say that we've fared better in the last 3 years of a very difficult recession because we knew our customers a lot better.
But not all community banks have done as well. In some cases, they didn't have the reserves to survive the current drop in real estate and other asset prices. But financial services expert and activist Jared Gardner has a plan.
It was really the economic crisis where we started to see the community banks suffering while the big banks are getting bailed out. And knowing that community banks support small business and our local farmers, we wanted to figure out a way to shore that up.
Gardner wants his state government to start up a kind of mini Federal Reserve, a state-owned bank that can act as a rich uncle to retail banks that want to lend to worthy borrowers.
It's a state-run bank, but it's a banker's bank. They have very little interface with the actual public. So they provide the needs of community banks, and they set their policies to get the most money into the community.
The one example of a state-run bank is here. It's called the Bank of North Dakota. Bremer's CEO sees it as a partner and calls this pint-sized Fed a tremendous resource. Many public officials are fans as well. The Bank of North Dakota gives its profits not to charity, but to the state. Over the last decade, $300 million went to North Dakota's treasury. That's one reason that Oregon and other states are looking at setting up state banks of their own. In Page, North Dakota, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
David's going to be hosting a public television special report this week. It's called Fixing the Future, a road trip that he took, trying to find new ways to move the economy along about its business. There's more at the Economy 4.0 blog on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up with poorly trained teachers, it's not only the kids who suffer.
It has impacted every quality of life indicator. Our ability to recruit business, high-paying jobs, health care.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 173 points today, 1.5%, closed at 11,181. The NASDAQ added 38 points, also 1.5%, 25.14 at the bell. The S&P 500 tacked on 18 points. That would be... Wait, what? Oh, yeah. about 1.5%, ended things at 11.96. We told you about Ireland. That fired up financial stocks, none more than the U.S. shares of Bank of Ireland. They leapt 33% today. U.S. banks rode its coattails as debt fears eased. Citigroup deposited 2.6%. Morgan Stanley followed with a 1.9% gain. General Motors also helped ignite the rally. The carmaker sped out of the gates on its return as a public company. GM lost some steam by day's end, but still notched a 3.6% gain. Bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.9%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Obama is in Portugal for the two-day NATO summit. Party at Abe's Place. The United States Mint holds a launch ceremony for the Lincoln $1 coin at President Lincoln's cottage in Washington, D.C. Oh, and I think there's a new movie opening, something called Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. Expect lines. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Chinese government won't officially say there is a property bubble building in its biggest cities, but actions sometimes do speak louder than words. Beijing announced some new real estate rules this week. From now on, foreigners are only going to be allowed to own one piece of property apiece. There are also limits on how many houses its own citizens can buy. And the government has spent much of this past year tightening up on credit as a way to cool things off. We've got our China correspondent, Rob Schmitz, on the line to talk things over. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So walk us through this, would you? What are the signs? How do we know that there's a property bubble in China?
Well, it boils down to this. If you're Chinese and you've got money you'd like to invest, there's not much you can do with it. China has a closed capital account. That means you can't legally invest outside the country. You could put your money in a bank, but guess how much interest you earn if you put your money in a Chinese bank?
Yeah, like not so much.
Yeah, around 2%. That's less than the inflation rate. So given that limited range of investment options, property has become the safest place to park your money in China.
Is this one of those things where everybody who can do it, everybody who's got the capital, is investing in property?
The money supply in China has increased by 50% over the past 2 years. So that's a lot of cash sloshing around the Chinese economy right now. And with a good portion of that, you know, going into real estate, that's pushed up property prices out of reach for most Chinese and led to a fear that there's an oversupply of real estate in China, that it's overpriced, and therefore you've got a potential bubble.
Okay, wait. You just told me that there's an oversupply of housing stock for a country with 1.4 billion people in it. Make that make sense for me.
Yeah, well, if you come to Shanghai and Beijing these days, I mean, you'll see high-rise apartments as far as you can see, you know, and many of them are just sitting there. They've been bought, but they're vacant. The apartment complex where I live is a good example. In a city of 20 million, I don't have any neighbors. The apartments on both sides of me are empty. And you see a lot of this in different urban centers in China. And the thing is, many of the country's smaller cities out west are developing the same way. If you want to see what's become the poster child for this problem, you can go to Marketplace's website and take a look at photos from my trip to Inner Mongolia.
Yeah.
Local officials there have built a city the size of Pittsburgh with barely any people living there. So this sort of thing is happening, you know, in pockets throughout China, and it's got a lot of people worried.
What about the hype, though? What about the fact that the media keeps saying, oh, there's this property bubble and people see that and they say, oh, I got to get in before it gets any higher?
I think there's good reason to say that there isn't a property bubble. One is that no matter how crazy expensive property is becoming in some cities here, income levels are rising too. And many in China's rural population are moving to urban centers where they're going to need housing. The second reason is a simple statistic from a recent real estate survey in China. Around a quarter of all home buyers in China are paying for their home with 100% cash.
Wow.
That's a far cry from what happened in the U.S. where you could borrow 100% to buy a home. That's one of the reasons why some think there's no way that there's a property bubble forming. You simply don't have the massive borrowing that you had prior to the real estate crash in the U.S.
You know, the Chinese economy, though, Rob, is so opaque. I mean, there must be more at play here than just simple supply and demand, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of unknowns in the Chinese economy. And we know that many Chinese are coming up with their down payments for their property by getting loans from what are called underground banks. And now these are informal networks of friends, family, coworkers who pool money together for investments like property. What we don't know is how much money is flowing through these types of shadow banks. But this is important to keep in mind because if property prices do take a dive, these informal lenders aren't going to provide the safety net of a huge state-owned bank, and that could increase the severity of a real estate market downturn. Now, the other unknown is what if China's government gives its people more freedom to invest money elsewhere? Then you might see a big sell-off in the property market so that people could invest in these new possibilities. While that might not be a dramatic pop to the bubble, it could mean a lot of people losing their money.
And so what, are you going to buy over there or what?
Here in Shanghai, you got a couple $1 million you want to? You can lend me.
Right. Marketplace of China correspondent Rob Schmitz in Shanghai for us. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, guy.
For all the conversations we have in this country about education, how to pay for it, how to raise kids' test scores, how to make the U.S. more competitive, there is one big chunk of the education ecosystem that doesn't get a whole lot of attention: how teachers are taught. This week, a panel set up by the group that accredits teacher training programs in this country said we ought to chuck the whole thing and start all over again. They said teachers should be trained more like doctors, with more time spent learning on the job with actual kids. Louisiana has already signed on to those recommendations. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the education desk at WYPR that Louisiana has already had a head start at education reinvention.
There was something wrong in Louisiana. In the late 1990s, on pretty much every national measure, the state's public school students lagged behind most of the country. And students weren't the only ones paying the price.
It has impacted every quality of life indicator. Our ability to recruit business, high-paying jobs, health care, all the lists that get published every year, Louisiana tends to be on the bottom.
Bridget Neeland was part of a state commission set up to get at the roots of the problem. She surveyed hundreds of teachers. Nearly all of those who had graduated from one of the state's colleges of education said the same thing. They felt unprepared to teach. Neeland says a third of new teachers didn't last beyond 3 years.
This pipeline was leaking at every level. The standards to get into colleges of education were low. Scores on national certification exams were low. The student teaching experience was generally not realistic. It was broken. There's no doubt it was broken.
The state finally told its colleges and universities to fix their teacher training programs or shut them down. One of the schools that got that message is the University of Louisiana at Monroe. It was homecoming week when I visited. Those are the Warhawks you hear practicing for the big game. ULM is a small university in the northeastern part of the state. It turned out nearly 150 new teachers last year. Luke Thomas was dean of the College of Education when the order came down to shape up or shut down. ULM had just finished its own redesign.
So we basically, starting around 2002, 2003, had to redesign the redesign. There weren't too many happy people in our college at that time.
But Thomas and his colleagues went along with it. They raised admission standards, made students take more courses in the subjects they'd be teaching, like science, and tripled the amount of time they spent in the classroom. Not the university classroom with its lectures and theory, but in the schools. At Cypress Point Elementary School, fifth graders sit at their desks in clusters of three or four. Each cluster also includes a college student from ULM, dressed in black hospital scrubs. A word about the scrubs, all the teachers wear them. Education can get messy. Today, these future teachers are helping kids learn about word choice. Junior Mindy Beach tries to get her group talking about other choices they make.
What kind of good choices affect your future?
Eating right and getting to stay in school.
Beach isn't cutting it. The professor, Beth Ricks, swoops in to give her a lesson in how to grab a fifth grader's attention. Enthusiasm.
What's another way to say it? It's a good choice. It's a, what kind of choice is
excellent.
Excellent. Oh, I love that word. Nice word.
Right after class, Beach and 30 or so other teachers in training debrief with Professor Ricks in the elementary school's library.
It's been 5 to 6 weeks that we've been working with the traits, right? So I want you to think about...
The aim is to bring the university classroom into the field so students can put what they learn right into practice. Senior Samantha Whitlock says the transition from lecture hall to public school classroom wasn't easy.
It's very overwhelming to go from just sitting in a classroom all day long, taking notes and then expected just to take a test, to going into the classrooms and working with the kids. It was something totally different than I ever expected.
By the time Whitlock becomes an official student teacher next year, she will have spent almost 200 hours working directly with children in the schools. That's 200 hours before she begins student teaching. Some states require as few as 15 classroom hours. That's the kind of experience Christella Dawson is looking for. She's assistant principal at Neville High School across town. She's seen her share of new teachers trained the old way.
They were gung-ho about teaching, but then they'd get into the classroom with the regular students on a day-to-day basis and would not know how to maintain control of the classroom.
Today, she says, candidates come in prepared. But are Louisiana's kids any better off? They've made progress, but the state still ranks close to the bottom on national scores.
The problem in education is that you don't see the benefits immediately.
Luke Thomas, the former dean who led ULM's redesign, says it'll be years before we know if it worked. And with this week's national report calling for teacher education to be turned upside down, it may not be long before the university has to rethink how it trains teachers all over again. In Monroe, Louisiana, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, in part two of her story, Amy's going to tell us how other approaches to training new teachers might stack up.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. By Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, slightly different perspective on the news we started with, the GM IPO, of course. GM shares, as we said, gained about 3.5% today. Over the past 3 months, though, Toyota is up about 9%, Ford's up 33% or so. Biggest gainer for car makers since this summer, Tesla. The electric car company is up 60% since it went public back in June. I saw one of its Roadsters on the way home yesterday. They are, I will tell you, pretty nice. Of course, they're also $100,000. So, you know, forget that. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All three main indices gained more than 1.5% today. The Dow rose 173 points. The NASDAQ up 38 points. The S&P 500 tacked on 18 points. Also, Tesla doesn't make a minivan as far as I know. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast. You ever drive past a billboard with a food ad on it and suddenly find yourself really hungry?
Everybody in America knows that the burger doesn't look like that. But the imagery itself is so powerful that it still entices people to buy.
America's relationship with food in pictures on the radio. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.